Before we begin, Joe has a note in his gorgeous handwriting. I love getting letters from him because the handwriting, if not only for also the content of the letter. For research purposes, Joe needs a concert-sized Lambert cylinder. Now, I'm sure we all have a few of those. And he is working with a concert wax experimentally, but that's fairly hazardous, as you know. Those things are, you put them on there and hope that they will not split in two pieces. As a trade, he has a Bettini cylinder with a signed slip. And so it's time for Let's Make a Deal. Here's Joe Penga. You don't get Let's Make a Deal over there, so you're lucky on that. So, and also, anyone who lives where there is an interesting Cornish community, please let Joe know also. That's the area of the country that he is from and is interested in all types of music of that area. Now, let me see here. This particular session came to mind originally as Joe had sent me some Xeroxes of the controversial Letters to the Editor series that have appeared in Gramophone magazine. I gave you the citations in the newsletter, and Joe has some copies of some of these things to give out. He'll mention that later. It just started fairly innocently and has just sort of mushroomed. And these recordings actually are so rare and scarce and easily misspeeded that, you know, when you are playing them back, that the controversy still continues. I had tried to send a tape of Cantor Rosenblatt's falsetto voices to Joe, you know, to sort of tie in with Henry's talk, but he left the country before he got the tape. So here now, all the way from England in his flying, is Joe Pengelly.
That's a good start. You've got my tape.
That's what I'm worried about.
Yes.
Fine. Okay. Lovely.
Yeah.
It's all lead it off. While they're doing that. Well, first let me thank you for inviting me here. And so may I preface, before we get into the main content, just 2 or 3 minutes, and I can assure you my piece will run between 35 minutes 40 and 37:33, so you know when you're going to get your lunch. So if you would bear with me with a short introduction, which runs about 2 minutes, and perhaps an apparent piece of material on the tape which is irrelevant, which will probably be, hopefully, be seen to be highly relevant. So here it is, the castrato, countertenor, and alto voices. When in 1981 your president Tim Brooke rang the BBC inviting me to be a contributor to the 1981 Arts Conference at Chapel Hill, I wasn't sure what to expect. Certainly, I was delighted to receive, even with trepidation, an invitation from what must surely be the most prestigious organization of its kind in the world, and manifested as such both by meetings like this and externally by the Ask Journal and its associated publications. And this is said in no gratuitous sense. It was, therefore, with the greatest pleasure that I came to Chapel Hill in 1981 to renew acquaintance not only with those few of your countrymen whom I'd earlier met at the Edinburgh Phonograph Centenary Symposium in 1977, but to meet those buffs whose expertise I knew of only by the written word. Professor Starr, I remember at Columbia, called them POBs, print-orientated bastards. To experience their breadth of knowledge, but above all their unbounded enthusiasm, are highlights in my recorded memory bank. Stereo, of course, and 15 IPS. The further friendships formed at Chapel Hill have been nurtured since, both by welcome visits to my home in England by ASK members and by a welcome flow of correspondence across the Atlantic. You will therefore understand my pleasure at being invited for a second time to contribute to an ASK conference, and I thank you for it. Well, at Chapel Hill, I spoke and played recordings to illustrate my paper on the technical and subjective replication of archival sound, not merely by technical reference, but also by reference to that final arbiter, the human ear. Well, here now is how I realized, with its perception by the ear very much in mind, Ada Jones, coming off Edison Wax Amberol, number 725 of 1911, a recording of mine, by the way, accepted by the White House last year for inclusion in its library of recordings, kept, I understand, for the entertainment, both of those whose tenancy is limited to 4 years, and also for the guests they entertain. Ada Jones, All Alone.
Hello Central, hello Central, give me 603. Please don't keep me waiting here, want to talk with Georgie dear. Hello Georgie, goodness gracious me. Well now at last I've got you dear, this is your Marie. I've been trying hard all day to get you on the phone to say I'm all alone, nobody here but me. All nice and cozy, everything is rosy, we'll have lots of. Hurry up and get here, honey, take a car, it's not far. My time is all my own. Hurry up, there's something missing. We'll have lots of kissing. Pa and Ma have left me all alone.
Are you all alone?
Mm-hmm.
All alone?
There's nobody here but me.
All is night and cozy, everything is rosy. They'll have lots of.
Hurry up and get here, honey.
Take a car, it's not far, but time is all her own. Hurry up, there's something missing.
We'll have lots of kissing.
Pa and Ma have left her all alone.
Well, now, I hope you won't accuse me of playing that extract and accuse me of dragging in material irrelevant to my presentation of today. It is, in fact, germane to it, since it was in the realization of the Moreschi Castrato recordings that I became aware that in their recreation, heard on contemporary equipment or on modern electrical replay gear, there must be some quality missing to justify Moreschi's titles both of Angelo di Roma, Angel of Rome, and Angelo di Vaticano, Angel of the Vatican. And presumably, you can't do much better than to be classed as an angel in that particular establishment. Remember, too, that in 1900, Moreschi was already a member of the Sistine Chapel Choir, and he sang at the funeral of King Umberto I of Italy. And he would surely not have been invited to do so unless his voice in actuality had a distinction and quality not captured on his early and primitive recordings. I seem to recall at the inauguration of your presidency, you have some preeminent singer who comes along and sings at the inauguration. And so my point is here that surely Moreschi would not have been invited to sing at such an occasion unless there was some particular quality to his voice which isn't apparent on the recordings. Well, let's hear what sort of sound Moreschi makes, coming off a disc recorded by Sinclair Darby in Rome in 1904, and played here after a great deal of research by Peter Cox of Britain at a speed of 74 RPM. Well, your comments on the correctness of this speed, and indeed on all matters raised in this presentation, will of course be welcome at the conclusion of the paper. Professore Alessandro Moreschi, coming off a 10-inch gramophone concert record, C54774, matrix number 2183H, with his rendering of part of Pier Gesù. On the basis of that and other Moreschi recordings, I put to Professor Domenico Mancini in Rome, and late of the Sistine Chapel, and the last surviving pupil of Moreschi, how a knowledgeable and critical Italian public, known both for their volatile praise and condemnation of singers, could bestow the title of angel on such a performer. Well, this is what he told me, and if your Italian isn't up to scratch, I'll follow it with a translation.
È un ricordo soave di Moreschi perché oltre che era detto l'angelo del Vaticano, era molto amabile e a me mi ha sempre tanto voluto bene e perché gli ho fatto onore come allievo. Era detto l'angelo del Vaticano perché aveva una voce potentissima. Dentro la chiesa di San Pietro si sentiva una cosa meravigliosa, indescrivibile.
Well, if your Italian isn't up to it, he was saying, I have very happy memories of Moreschi because firstly, apart from being the angel of the Vatican, he was a very lovable man. Secondly, he was very fond of me. And thirdly, he did me the honor of taking me as his pupil. He was called the Angel of the Vatican because he had a most striking voice. Inside St. Peter's, you were aware of something marvelous, indescribile. Well, my point is here. No, it isn't, it's on here. And Professor Mancini, if not indescribile, was himself a singer of some quality. Here's part of a recording of his that I made at his home of necessity over mic onto a cassette, and with the disc being played on a very ancient and inefficient Roman record player. It is, though, some account of how a Sistine Chapel falsettist trained by Moreschi sounded, and you may perhaps hear a similarity common to both master and pupil. Certainly, if Moreschi was vastly superior to his pupil, as he undoubtedly was, then it must truly have been indescribable. An indescribability certainly not captured in the primitive recordings by which Moreschi is now judged. Well, here now is Moreschi's pupil, Domenico Mancini, recorded electrically in the 1930s, but with a voice powerful enough, even away from the microphone, to give open-air concerts in Rome. My point is here that even by my own terms of reference, marrying technical considerations with subjective musicality, is it possible to recreate the actual sound of a voice? This is something we were mentioning yesterday, especially in the case of a castrato voice, of which there is only one known example, Moreschi. I read, for example, in Dr. Marafiotti's book, Caruso's Method of Voice Production and the Singer's Laryngologist, of the great tenor's velvet quality of voice. Well, that's something I have never heard emanating from any recording. How then is it possible to hear with any sense of certainty what a castrato voice truly sounded like? Certainly, Moreschi was only the last surviving example of a famous tradition. But what is at once apparent is the obvious brilliance and power of his voice, cutting into the wax master with all the incisiveness to equal, if not exceed, that of a young Caruso. Here's Moreschi again, coming off a 1904 Sinclair Derby 10-inch gramophone concert record, C54780, matrix number 2199H. Sharing the recording of Laudamus Te with Moreschi is the baritone or bass, Professor Dardo, and the beefy tenor, Professor Cesare Boesi, and with the castrato voice more than holding its own in terms of vocal power and brilliance vis-a-vis the other two. And Dardo leads off. To a recording of a falsetto male alto recorded acoustically like Moreschi, but some 16 years later in 1919, and with a corresponding improvement in recording techniques, here's the noted British alto Ben Millett, coming off HMV disc E69 matrix 5-2032. He was the alto soloist of the Church of the Immaculate Conception at Farm Street in London, and he sings here parts of Elgar's Ave Verum.
Oh,
Well, the breathy and tenuous quality of the falsetto alto is at once apparent, and surely it can't claim to be a voice in any real sense in the way that Moreschi's is. This, I submit, is because the alto voice is invariably the falsetto extension of a bass or baritone voice, and by its very nature and definition, false and tenuous. That is not to say, however, that the male alto voice is not capable of a beautiful sound, but in my experience, it cannot perform solo unless reinforced by the acoustic found in cathedrals, its usual habitat, or by the electrical recording process. Indeed, I know of one